tape is rolling.
Great.
Jonathan, you've said that a lot of the writers you admire the most seem to be trying to be a different writer each time they write a new book, and that you would like to be that kind of writer. So I'm curious, has this novel, Dissident Gardens, taken you in a substantially new direction?
Well, yeah, I think it has in a whole bunch of different ways. I mean, first of all, it's, you know, I find myself having difficulty even saying the words. It's a historical novel, right? And I'd never done that before, and I hadn't even really identified with it. You know, I've tried a lot of different genres, you know, some of them the kind of corny genres that have bookstore sections in them and that people are embarrassed to be known to like, and some of them, you know, what I would say are like deep genre, like, you know, that sort of hides within other categories, like the academic satire. You know, I wrote one of those. But I never thought I liked reading historical novels. I like reading old fiction. I'd like reading about the 1950s by people who were alive and writing about it as it happened. But when I realized that I was setting out to do this, I was really at sea because I had to convince myself of something that as a reader I find very, very difficult to be convinced of, which is that the writer can have any meaningful authority over these periods that he's reconstructing, you know, in retrospect.
So you felt like you had to know about those previous historical eras to make them convincing.
I did, but yeah, not just in a sort of obvious historical sense. And I, you know, I did a certain amount of just research into stuff that happened, but I also really needed to get into other kinds of language and even like just mental frameworks. I had to read a lot of novels, including a lot of bad ones, a lot of forgotten ones, written by, you know, in my case, by like New York Jewish leftists at the time. You know, often these books have been nudged aside because they were too deep inside the material. They reflected kind of, you know, grudges or factions, or they were just, you know, just too close to the material, and they started to immediately molder and seem kind of like they were just a byproduct of a social time that had been, you know, that people were mercifully leaving behind. But I had to go there and kind of let myself suffuse in the way people thought and felt on the ground. You know, even you know, read a certain amount of propaganda, honestly, to be able to understand how it felt to think inside or, you know, try to think outside of that stuff at the time.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested that you describe this as a historical novel, which obviously it is, as opposed to, say, a political novel, because it is so heavily immersed in the worlds of communism and of political activism.
Yeah. Well, it's a depiction of characters who are defined by their commitment, their crazy passion for, you know, revolutionary change, for utopia. They want to live in a world other than the one that they've been given. And they do this in all sorts of mixed up ways in various parts of the 20th century and even on into the present, which for me actually was one of the keys to persuading myself of the project to begin with. I thought if I bring it to the present, I'll give evidence that I know what I feel is so true, that this story hasn't ended. It's not something sealed up in the past.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about what you think of the political novel, which has kind of been, I don't know if discredited is the right word, but it's fallen on hard times. I mean, there was a time back in the 1930s when some of the great writers out there, people like John Steinbeck and John Dispassos, wanted to write the political novel. I mean, they didn't want to just be literary. They wanted a call to action. They wanted their readers to go out and change the world. Does that history have any resonance for you?
Well, I think if the political novel is defined by that standard you just offered, I haven't come close to meeting it, because this book would be a very, very hard banner to march under. You know, like, let us now go and what? What would we do?
Become disillusioned, maybe?
Yeah, it's more a kind of, you know, I think for me, I don't really recognize a clear definition that I can cozy up to in the idea of the political novel. Instead, this is a book about political people. And I mean, I feel, if anything, you know, honestly, if you want to know what I think politically, you might be better off going to some other things I've written. You know, a novel called Chronic City, for me, is an emblem of all kinds of political outrage I felt that's sort of sublimated into this crazy story. And I wrote a little study of a film called They Live, a John Carpenter horror movie that to me seemed like a really incredibly pregnant political text. And by writing about it, I think I committed myself to a lot of political views, really. This book isn't really like that. This is about the human experience of wanting the world to be other than it is. And to me, that's, you know, in a way, it could almost have been done as readily from the right. I could have written this book about, you know, people who believe that McCarthy was right and then wanted, Barry Goldwater to be president and then are in the Tea Party. Because it was my insight that American identity was made up of this kind of, you know, that to be communist in the era that my characters were was actually a very American choice to make. It was very characteristic to be fitful and utopian and kind of place oneself at odds with history. That was a characteristic way of participating in our history.
Now, I've heard that one of your main characters, Rose Zimmer, was to some degree modeled on your own grandmother. Is that right?
More than to some degree. I mean, I think I started the book thinking I'm going to take everything I know about my grandmother and put it into this character and then work from there and start from there. Now, of course, once you start summoning up all the things a child can know about a very complicated, very dark, very intense, charismatic, but also very silent and enigmatic older woman, it turns out there's not much. So I had a lot to invent as well. I had to surround my suspicions and my projections about my grandmother with all sorts of information from other places and from other people's lives, frankly, and also with just my own crazy, you know, wishfulness, my fantasies about, you know, I mean, for instance, the book is very much about this woman's sex life in some ways, even when it's not a one that's being realized. She has this series of fantasy boyfriends. It kind of begins with Karl Marx and goes to Abraham Lincoln and Fiorello LaGuardia, and she ends up in a fantasy relationship with Archie Bunker.
I have to ask you about Archie Bunker from All in the Family. Yeah. I mean, the premise here is so absurd. It's hilarious. I mean, Rose is this aging Jewish communist at this point, and Archie Bunker, of course, was the quintessential bigot, and she falls in love with him in her imaginary world.
Yeah. Well, she's got this perverse streak in her that's very confusing for her, I think, that she's into authority. She likes, she kind of likes the beat cop, and she likes the neighborhood priest, and she likes mayors and presidents. There's something about the command and the assurance that she's excited about, and she wants to retrieve this for her own purposes. But she's also, I think, in a kind of it's a very personal feeling for her. And then at the end of her life, when most of the justifications that she held so close, you know, that had allowed her to maintain a kind of pure, hardline communist perspective have been stripped away from her. History has denied her any solace, you know, basically as it did to true believers throughout the 20th century. It was a series of shocks and humiliations. What's left to her is her relationship to the neighborhood. She's become, despite herself, a resident of Queens. And she begins to see this tapestry of kind of ethnic styles, you know, that Archie Bunker exemplifies as having its own power and authority. And so she's really into his charisma and his willfulness and his the way you identify with him, you know, without wanting to, you know, even though he's saying absurd things, you lean forward. And so she herself is thinking, if I could only have Archie for a minute, if I could only lure him into my bed, I would change him. You know, I'd make him think right.
The ultimate leftist fantasy, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in fact, I'd love to get a taste of your story and of Rose. And maybe we can go back to the very beginning, the opening, when
sure.
It's sort of this classic moment of American communism here. Could you read that?
Okay, here goes. Quit screwing black cops or get booted from the Communist Party. There stood the ultimatum, the absurd sum total of the message conveyed to Rose Zimmer by the cabal gathered in her Sunnyside Gardens kitchen that evening, late fall 1955. Saul Eaglin, important communist, had rung her telephone. A committee wished to see her. No, they'd be happy, delighted, to come to her home. This evening, after their own conference just across the gardens, was 10 too late? This was a command, not a question. Yes, Saul knew how hard Rose labored, what her sleep was worth. He promised they wouldn't stay long. How did it happen? Easy. Routine, in fact. These things happened every day. You could get exiled from the cause for blowing your nose or blinking at suspicious intervals. Now, after so long, Rose's turn. She'd cracked the kitchen windows to hear their approach, brewed some coffee. Sounds of the gardens filtered in. Smokers, lovers, teenagers sulking in the communal lanes. Though winter's dark had clamped itself over the neighborhood hours ago, this early November night was uncannily balmy and inviting, last pulse of the earth's recollection of summer. Other kitchen windows were spilled to the lanes, voices mingled. Rose's plentiful enemies. Fewer friends. Others, so many others, simply tolerated. Yet, comrades all. According Rose their respect, even through their dislike. Respect to be robbed from her by the committee now entering her kitchen. There were five, including Eaglin. They'd overdressed, overcompensated with vests and jackets, now arraying themselves on her chairs like some Soviet oil painting, postured as if on some intellectual assignment. In pursuit of that chimera, the dialectical huzis, when really there was to be no dialectic here, only dictatorship. And the taking of dictation. Still, Rose ought to be forgiving. These men were too young, apart from Eaglin, to have survived like she had the intellectual somersaults of the 30s, the onset of European fascism and of the Popular Front. They'd been children during the war. They were drones, men costumed in independent thought who'd become slaves of party groupspeak. None mattered in this room except the sole independent or thoughtful among them. A true and famous organizer, after all, a man of the factory floors, Saul Eaglin, and Rose Zimmer's former lover. Eaglin in his bow tie, hairline now gone behind his high cranium's arc like the winter's sun setting. Eaglin, the only among them man enough not to meet her eye, the only to grasp anything of the shame of it. Here was communist habit, communist ritual, the living room trial. The respectable lynch mob that availed themselves of your hospitality while dropping some grenade of party policy on your commitment, lifting a butter knife to slather a piece of toast and using it in passing to sever you from that to which you'd given your life. Yet that it was communist habit and ritual didn't mean these boys were good at it or comfortable. Rose was the veteran. She'd suffered one such trial 8 years ago. They sweated. She only felt exhaustion at their hemming and throat clearing.
Oh, that is so great. And you capture so much in just a couple of pages there.
Well, thanks.
And, you know, the true believers. And it's true believers who, well, I mean, you go back to that era in American history, and then you pick up the political scene with the hippies of the 60s and 70s, and you take it all the way up to the Occupy Wall Street movement. Why did you want to sort of trace that arc?
Well, it connects, for one thing, to the first question you asked and my reply, that the historical novel seems to me very hard to trust. You know, like, how can we really believe that the past is like this? Well, one way of testing it, or any way of being honest about this uncertainty that I felt, is to bring it right to the present so as to say, look, it connects, but also the past is a construction of the present. We have no way back there. We can only think about it on the terms of present experience and with present language, and it's probably being colonized at every corner by our current framework and our current thinking. And, you know, I guess I also wanted to encompass my own sensations. I grew up as a kid who was taken to protests, and I continue to, you know, be some sort of protester or activist for a long time after that. I guess
Didn't you grow up in a Brooklyn commune?
It was a commune, and you know, my parents' stance was, by the time I came of age, was that of, you know, Vietnam War protesters who, you know, my father had specifically sort of lost his teaching job because he'd allied himself with the students against Vietnam. So he was a carpenter now. So he was really, in some way, his anti-institutional, you know, bone had dictated the course of his life and therefore of our family's life. And I took this as a given, as any kid does. I thought, that's right, we're you know, our life is enlivened by these righteous causes, and we're going to be on the march for one thing or another, whether, you know, it became after the war, it became in favor of daycare centers in New York City or against nuclear power, you know, the Helen Caldicott era. So I wanted the book to go from the past all the way into the stuff I could feel with my own nervous system.
So are you proud of that family history, that political family history?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I don't think it all means one simple big thing, but it means a lot to me. And I wanted this book to express a lot of my sense of the vitality in you know, caring to change the world this way, even when those impulses become defeated or confused or mixed up or compromised in some way, and also to really talk about some of the enormous accomplishments, you know, the way we don't think of, for instance, the civil rights movement as having anything to do with the American communists. You know, it's like, what, this is one of the great accomplishments of American liberalism, right? But when you go and you look at the track record, well, the foot soldiers, the people kind of carrying the water early on are almost all, paradoxically, you know, like dedicated revolutionists who saw this as a near-to-hand instance of an egalitarian cause that, you know, expressed what they felt the world should be like.
So to bring this up to the present then, were you inspired by the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Yeah, it meant a lot to me. I was inspired by it. I was perplexed by it. Here we are, you know, we're speaking of it in the past tense, which is almost irresistible to do because it seems that it's evaporated, right? But I think that it's so fresh, and its enunciation was so intense. You know, it's like we suddenly had an American left again, and it did in an inordinately short period of time. You know, like it was like in 140 characters, it did everything the American left had ever done before, right? It was like a tweet. It totally named the enemy. Suddenly you could be, there was capitalism and you could be anti-capitalist, which was an incredible change, sea change in the American conversation, I think. And it became mired in all sorts of, you know, factionalist difficulties, but also became mired in something much more important, even if it was very, very difficult for the movement, which was taking care of people who were presenting themselves to it. Suddenly it was like feeding and housing. You know, it became a street rescue operation because once you put yourself onto the streets, you deal with, you know, the lives that are being lived on the streets. And you know, that legacy is still with us, the way Occupy goes and rescues people after hurricanes now, yeah, and so forth. So what it all meant, I think we're a long way from really grasping.
So I'm wondering how you approach that then as a novelist, you know, not just the Occupy movement, but, you know, going back and, you know, and not just reporting on this as history, as nonfiction, but as a literary exercise. Were there precedents? I mean, were there other writers you looked to who'd done this kind of thing? Or sort of how did you want to turn that into a novel?
Well, sure. I had a lot of, I mean, if you want to talk about sources or points of reference, I had a lot of great ones. I had, you know, a novel by Christina Stead called I'm Dying Laughing. And I had Philip Roth at a couple of points in his work, you know, obviously specifically I Married a Communist, but also the way he deals with both legacies and the present in a book like The Human Stain. I had a lot of things to reach for. To answer the first part of your question, the only thing a novelist can do is fall back on what is a novelist's thing to do, which is invest in the people. You know, these histories are bewildering. No historian could give you a full, you know, comprehensive grasp of what these things were, what happened, what they all meant. You couldn't do it in 10 volumes of history. A novelist can't even begin to assign himself or herself that job. Instead, it's about how did it feel? What did it mean to people to care, to try, to be stopped here or feel that history had tricked you there, but still know that there was something beautiful in your commitment and that it mattered and you know, just transmit the human experience in many cases of being bewildered at what is the legacy? Well, I can't solve it for you, but I can make you feel it.
Yeah. Now, one thing I'm curious about is the style that you adopted to tell the story. Now, you are well known for your very well crafted sentences, and you have some very long sentences in this book too. I don't know if it's sort of longer than usual, and I'm wondering if you felt like you had to take on, or if you chose to write this book in a different style to fit the subject.
Well, there were things that I did consciously, and there are things that I think invested themselves in the language from the sources. You know, I was writing about people who were explosive, people whose sense of their relationship to ideology, to language, to persuasion, to argumentation was explosive. And I was absorbing their manner of being, and the text, the language had to reflect that. But I also was, you know, really specifically thinking about a certain kind of, not just an intellectual style, but a New York street style that was, you know, grabbing you by the collar and not letting go. And I also, you know, the way to do a historical recreation is immersion. You've got to make the reader feel that they're drowning in a sense in details that they have to navigate. You know, when I read Dickens' London, I'm drowning in that London. I want my reader here to feel that they've been plunged into the past, not that they're just sort of dabbling at it, sampling a little, you know, item on a menu, but that they're gripped by another version of their familiar world that they have to acknowledge was, you know, is right under the surface of this one.
So we've talked about how you like to try to reinvent yourself with each new novel that you write. Are you going to try to do that with your next book? For all I know, you're already at work on it.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I sure would like to have another answer. But no, I'm actually at a weird interval that's different for me, because I often have plunged right into another project. And, you know, for instance, this book was well underway before the last novel was published. But I'm making a reconsideration at maybe an even deeper level. I want to sit with this feeling. I've got 3 or 4 possible projects. None of them have quite come into focus. I've been doing instead a series of, you know, what you might call, really rich finger exercises. I wrote a big review of Thomas Pynchon's book that was a lot of hard work to get right, and I wrote a liner note just now for an album of people covering Bob Dylan's songs from the 80s. Usually thought of as kind of his lost decade, but it's very dear to me. And I've got a short story I want to write. It's like I want to do anything but commit to a large, engagement that will sustain for years. Right now, I seem to need to be dodgy to myself.
Well, thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Oh, great. Great talking to you.